Good morning and welcome to the Friedberg Fourth Quarter Podcast. I'm David Rothberg, and it's my pleasure once again to welcome Al Friedberg, Portfolio Manager of the Global Macro Hedge Fund and the Friedberg Asset Allocation Fund. Good morning, Al. How are you doing?
Good morning. How are you, David?
Good,
Fine.
thank you. Good. We've got a lot to cover today. Most of the questions that we've got relate to the long discourse that you give on monetary data and your theories about or your thesis about money supply, and we'll cover that. But I think to tee us off, I'd like to go back to a year, to the fourth quarter of 2021 call that we had. That time, the issue was inflation, and I remember saying to you that I'd rarely heard you as committed to an idea, or I wouldn't say rarely, but it had been a long time since I'd seen you committed to an idea like you were to inflation at the end of last year, the beginning of 2022. And that commitment resulted in a terrific year for the Global Macro Fund in particular. Especially by the middle of the year, you were up almost supernatural numbers. And then in a typically volatile fashion, you still stayed up on the year, but we surrendered some of those gains. And you changed course. And you changed course with a mighty stroke, liquidated a great deal of that inflation position that you had, and eventually took it all off, and then made a second great bet on Japan. We'll get to Japan, but let's begin with inflation. You no longer have an inflation long position. Are you convinced now that the inflation issue has been tackled? If it has, like, what does it mean for assets?
Yeah, and by the way, that was very poetic. I really like that. Okay.
Thank you.
right. I think that the inflation issue is done. I believe that, and again, unwittingly, and we can talk about that, it's like an unwanted consequence of what the Fed did. The unwanted consequence is not the actual result. The result is wanted, but it's the mechanism by which it happened. But yes, the inflation issue is out of the picture. I believe that we now are likely to have a 2023 well below the 2% target, inflation target. And but what it means for a more difficult question is what it means for assets. Now, it would appear on the surface that for assets, it's favorable. And actually, I'm just reading the headline of today's Wall Street Journal. I think I have it here. The headline says, "Hope for a market recovery hinge on big drop in inflation." That's today's headline. So, yes, but it's not really as simple as that. And as we'll discuss it this morning, it may end up being actually not good for the market and not good for financial assets and other types of assets. We
Well,
can go into this,
let's
but
start off by asking ourselves if you're convinced that inflation has been rendered, can we market paid, as they used to say at Spadina and College? Can we market paid? And if so, why? Because I think the answer to that question will lead us to how we think about interest rates and money supply in general.
Right. Okay, so we have to start with the general statement that that inflation is a monetary element. There is something about money and the growth of money that causes prices to go up or down, and sometimes, and at least in the early stages, also causes economic activity, when it's unexpected, economic activity to go up or down. So because the central bank in the U.S. and probably central banks all over the world did the same, let money supply rise very quickly during that period of 2020-2021, we ended up having a very, very quick move up in prices, what we call inflation. It was aggravated in the sense, when I say aggravated, I mean the inflation was expressed primarily in items that were in short supply. So it looked like it was a supply chain problem. It wasn't a supply chain problem, but it looked like it was because that's where inflation was concentrated in. It deceived most of central banks around the world. They all waited a little bit longer than they should have, or much longer than they should have. I don't think that they realized what really caused inflation. And when finally they started realizing that, they began, all of them, in almost in unison, began to raise interest rates. Even the move, even the rising interest rate policy that they took on, and it was mostly an interest rate, let's call it, it was an interest rate policy, right? It was something that it was like a modified Taylor rule, let's say. The Taylor rule would have, had they followed the Taylor rule, they would have had a much higher rate in 2021. But they moved towards a Taylor rule, which I think at the time may have been signaling them to go to 8 or 9% or something like that. But they started moving up. And as they moved up, something of unwanted consequences took place. When I say unwanted consequences, I mean it's unintended consequences. That's a better word to use. What happened in effect was that because of a mechanism that was put in place maybe 10, 12 years ago, banks are able to keep reserves at the Federal Reserve and get remunerated for that. They get interest in that. That was not the case in the olden days. And because it wasn't the case like in the olden days, whenever banks ended up with a large amount of excess reserves that were not needed, at the time there was a rule that a certain percentage of demand deposits and time deposits had to be deposited at the Fed. Anything above that was not earning interest, and the banks were very quick in using it. So they would draw down reserves and make loans or buy treasuries. And that would stimulate a growth in money supply or in private deposits. It turns out that after the rule change was made, and for a long time, the interest rate paid on deposits was practically nothing, was practically zero. You remember that for many years, the Fed funds rate was at 0 or 0.25%, so it wasn't a factor. Right after the 2012, rates did go up a little bit, but banks were so traumatized by the Great Recession that we had in 2009 that also they preferred not to use their reserves. But it's only in the last few years when business began to get a little bit stronger, the economy got a little stronger, growth got a little stronger, banks were willing to make loans, to extend loans, banks were willing to buy securities to add to their portfolio, what you call today bank credit. Bank credit is a mix of securities purchases and loans that banks would normally draw from reserves to do that. But because the Fed was paying them interest and the rate of interest was attractive, and it's attractive because it's about the same as the rate of interest as the Fed funds rate. So today they would be getting 4.25 or 4.40 or something of that sort. It doesn't pay for banks to expand their portfolio beyond just some loans, risk adjusted, that give them a good enough return that's better than the 4.25%, 4.5%. All they need to do is actually keep money in reserves and earn the money. And that means also that there's no use, or there's no reason why banks would want to expand their bond portfolios, right? Because right now, with a negative, with an inverted yield curve, they would they earn less than they would earn at the Fed. And so banks, we find the banks are actually liquidating treasuries. They're selling treasuries, they're liquidating treasuries, and instead keep their money in reserves. That is the unintended consequence. And it's unintended. It is causing money supply to come to an abrupt halt. It was probably the most abrupt halt that we have seen in history. We went from rising very rapidly at an annual rate of 20, 30, 40% per annum. I don't recall the exact numbers, but money supply was growing very rapidly, and it came to a complete shocking halt in the first quarter of last year. And since then, money has been either flat or now actually down year over year a little bit. And it threatens to continue shrinking. That is the way we see it, and that is the unintended consequence, because the Fed is not, no central bank in the world, and the Fed especially, are not targeting money supply. They don't pay it attention. They don't discuss money supply. None of their releases discuss money supply. Money supply is not in the picture, just like it wasn't in the picture when they overdid it on the upside and created an inflation. It's not in the picture today, at least not for now. Occasionally, once in a while, somebody may mention money supply in one of these talks, Fed speaks, among other things, but it is not a variable that the Fed is watching or at least using or paying attention to. So that is the unintended consequence. This abrupt change in the rate of growth of money, to the point that now in absolute terms, we are flat to down year over year, is putting a tremendous stress in the financial market and in the economy too. And now I come to the economy for a moment. I said before that primarily money supply has to do with relates to crisis, which is true. But at points where the economy or where markets are not aware of what's happening quickly, in that transitional period, you have an effect or an impact on the economy first, on the real economy. So in this case, the real economy has actually begun to weaken very significantly. And we can talk about that later, but we believe that the recession has begun. The recession probably began late summer of last year. We will see that when we revise these numbers, as we always do. We'll see it in 6 months from now or in a year from now, that the recession has begun. The only reason why it is not evident 100% is because employment remains fairly strong. And we explain it. I explain it because of this idea that businesses are still hoarding labor. They had a very bad experience with getting people to work, getting people for what they need. And so they're still hoarding labor, but that is starting to unfreeze, starting to melt, starting to thaw. You're beginning to see already now many of the high-tech companies laying off people, 10,000 here, 18,000 there, 5,000 here. By the time this process is over, we're going to see a substantially higher rate of unemployment, substantially higher rate of unemployment. My guess is that it will happen very quickly, that suddenly the market will realize that we have entered a recession, there's no need to hoard labor, there's no need to have people around if they're not making any money, if their margins are being impacted. And so you're going to see that happen too. So the first effect will be on the economy, but it's already affected goods inflation. Goods inflation is probably negative at the moment. The reopening of the Chinese economy is providing some support still to some commodities, but not much. But we see them going lower. And what's left is services. And services are heavily influenced by labor costs. That too is starting to slow down. We've seen that some of the measures that we have show that wage costs are starting to slow to the 4% or less area. So and that's usually lower. It takes more time. Usually it takes more time, but that too will happen. And so that's the dilemma that we have now. We are moving into a very low inflation environment. We may move. We may, depends how long we stay in this shrinking money supply mode. We may move into an outright deflation. It is not what the market is expecting. It is not what CEOs are expecting. Therefore, the impact on economic activity can be severe. And that's why when I started, I said, you know, inflation having been subdued is good, but may not be good at this point for assets because of what's happening, because of what we see happening now with economy and inflation. Yeah.
So let me interject by trying to summarize what you're saying, because what you're saying is radical. In effect, you're saying that the market's focus on interest rates, whether we're going to go to 4.75, whether we're going to go to 5, whether they're going to lift by 50 basis points in February, whether they're going to lift by 25 basis points in February, these are not the salient issues. What's salient is that the Fed is not aware of the effects of money supply. They're not aware of the effect that specifically that the interest paid on reserves is having on money supply. And as a result, you have basically, and I don't think there's any other way of looking at this, you have a Federal Reserve that really doesn't have the control over the market that the investing public and economists generally assume that it has. That's one thing. The second implication is that we're in the early stages, or already in the throes of a bear market, and that this bear market can be significant because what you say is in no way priced in to securities prices, unless the Fed panics and lowers rates. But if the Fed lowers rates, the effect of the lowering of rates, if your thesis is true, should have very little effect, because what's really the critical issue is the interest that's paid on reserves.
Okay, 100%. So I'll start with the second point, and then I'll go back to the first. Absolutely. It's not the level of interest rates that makes such a difference. It is the differential that it's what they pay banks on reserves at the moment, and what they pay money market funds, for example, on the reverse repos that they do. That is the key, and so long as that's attractive, so long as that's a better rate and a safer rate. Remember, that's the overnight rate. There is no risk. There is no capital risk. It's not like buying a bond where if interest rates rise, the bond goes down. There is no risk in holding these, right? And so as long as it's attractive to keep the money at the Fed and earn those rates, you're going to see in effect a contraction of money. So even lowering rates will make a big difference, although I should say, that if the Fed does lower them dramatically and quickly, for example, let's say they were to move down rapidly from 4.5 or 5 to where they're going now to 2 or 2.5%, my guess is that those rates will become less attractive in relation to the market, because I'm guessing now that the yield curve will become positive, and banks will be able to seek better rates and get better rates by moving to the 5-year bond, for example, or the 10-year treasury. So if you lower the short-term rate enough, far enough, you probably will get a reversal in the slope of the yield curve, and you'll get a positive yield curve. And if you get a positive yield curve, the banks will be back in business buying securities. But that will take time. That will take time. I don't see the Fed moving very rapidly anymore. I think that they have been traumatized by what happened, and they should have been, because what they did was really unacceptable for a central bank to allow inflation to run so high and so fast. We're not going to, unless we had a deflation of 10% in the next 2 years, we're not going to be able to straighten that price level, and people will be hurt. People will have been hurt in this period. So it was a dereliction of their duties. So therefore, the Fed is not going to move fast. The chances are, as they see the economy, as they see unemployment rising, they'll first they stop raising rates, then they'll start lowering them maybe a quarter of the time, and maybe towards the end of the year they'll be coming down faster if the economy is really hurting. But that process will take time, and if the process takes time, and money continues to shrink, the damage could be very substantial, very 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 substantial. So I've answered your, or I've at least talked about your second point, and I think that you were right, absolutely right. It's a differential that makes a difference. Now let me go back to the first. When you say, and I say that, you know, the Fed is not aware, I don't mean that they're not aware from a mechanical point of view. They are clearly aware. The people at the research department are 8,000 people, and they know much more than we don't. We know about the mechanics of these flows, let's call it. So they are aware of what may be happening. The problem is that they're not willing to concede the idea that money or money supply is a factor in inflation and economic activity. This is something that was given up. Oh, it's called monetarism. This was given up in the 90s at the time because they couldn't get the kind of precise results that the present generation wants to see, you know, the kind of scientific result that they wanted to see. And so they had problems measuring money. They had problems in dealing with the lags of monetary policy. So in the end, they gave it up. Federal Reserve St. Louis was a bastion of monetarism. There's not one person there, I think, today that talks about it. So it's not as if they don't know the mechanism. They know the mechanism. They understand it well. I don't think they care. I don't think that they give it any significance. This too, for us, is a very dangerous thing, because if we are right, and if it is highly significant, and they don't think it's significant, and if we are right, then the damage to the economy could be very serious. So until they change, it could be a very significant impact.
I hear. Let's drill down a bit to the portfolio now. With that kind of theoretical construct as a starting point, if you're right, and if we're moving into a contraction phase, then we can expect a reaction by the Fed to lower rates, and the lower rates should have an effect, especially on tech stocks. It'll have an effect on PEs in general. PEs, as we know, has a much larger effect on securities prices than earnings have under all things being considered equally. But there will have an especially profound effect or direct effect on tech stocks. you have a negative bias towards tech stocks, and in your portfolio, you're short quite a bit of tech stocks. How does that jive with the overall theory?
Okay, so that's an important point, because, you know, the idea that multiples matter more than earnings, just the multiple itself matters more than earnings, it's not always. It is generally true, but it's not always the case. In other words, if the economy does have a very severe recession, or if this recession, this ongoing recession now, deepens and gets very, very nasty, you know, earnings can be destroyed. And so, of course, you can have P/E ratios of 40 to 1 or 50 to 1 because earnings are almost non-existent. You know, we have had recessions where earnings dropped dramatically and multiples were extremely high to compensate for that. But the question is, will it be high enough to compensate and not give you a drop? I don't know. Right now, it's the simple answer would be, if there is soft landing, earnings will be hurt a little bit, maybe 5%, maybe 10%. I think that the consensus of opinion now for earnings and the S&P are not showing any kind of a decline. Maybe just a slowdown, not any major kind of a decline. So given that, of course, and lower interest rates, you should have higher prices. But that may not be the case. And I don't think that will be the case. I think that its chances are good that the earnings of many of these companies will go down sharply. And then I'm not sure, and I don't believe that multiples will save them from going any lower. I don't think so. Again, it's not a 100% conviction, but I don't think that they will be saved by expanding multiples.
Go ahead.
There may be some sectors that are already cheap to begin with. For example, we own housing. Housing is cheap. Interest rates going down will give it a bit of a boost. So they may do better. Banks may do maybe a little bit better, maybe affected. In other words, we may continue to have a situation where some of the value stocks are selling relatively cheap, I don't know, in the area of 6 to 12 times earnings, may be saved by the expansion of multiples. But I don't know how the market will react to a very weak economy. It's very difficult to know. We have not really had, to the best of my knowledge, we have not had a very weak, what I call a very weak economy, since maybe the early 70s, since 1973, 74, 75. And when you get a very, very weak economy, you have a big change in sentiment. It's hard to know whether the lower rates, as I say, eventually the rates get low enough and we get a positive yield curve, I think that you can be a buyer of securities. But as long as you have a negative yield curve still, and as long as this phenomenon, this mechanism is working to shrink money, we think that it will affect mostly the high price stocks, meaning stocks that are trading at high times sales and still high multiples.
Okay. Just for clarification for listeners, when you talk about a weak economy, not since 1975, I assume the point you're making is that we haven't seen an economy that has been weak for what we might call organic reasons. We've had very weak economies, but they were the result of single events like the pandemic, like the housing crisis of 2008. But an organic type of a weak economy where many economic factors conspired to create years of distress. It's true.
It's more than that. It's more than that. In 1974, 75, I think unemployment rose to 11%. I mean, that was a very severe recession. It wasn't just a one quarter thing. It was a very severe recession. We haven't had such a recession in 4 years.
Right.
Even the 2009 was not such a severe recession.
Right. Let's look abroad. Many people are arguing that emerging markets or non-U.S. markets are the place to be. Emerging markets have bounced off their lows and have outperformed the S&P, the U.S. market, since I think the middle of October. You're not in emerging markets per se, but you are in Japan. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, okay. First, a word about emerging markets. Markets generally do well, or generally do very well, when the dollar is weak and when prices are rising. Some of their economies do very well in inflation, global inflations. They do very well, mostly because they're producers of raw materials. So that is a good environment for them. Is deflation a good environment for them? No. Deflation has never been a good environment for them, for emerging markets. So deflation, weak global economies have not been good. So I would not take refuge, let's say, in emerging markets. The interesting markets, in my view, would be, and I'm not 100% convinced that if this recession let me start with this. The interesting markets are the European and the Japanese markets. They're cheap. They're much cheaper than the U.S. Don't have this problem with shrinking money. I don't think the money is shrinking today there, and it's still growing in positive terms. Europe, on the other hand, has some problems, mostly energy problems, and also a war on its borders. So it's hard to make a very, very strong bullish case for Europe, but certainly won't be as affected as the U.S. And my guess is that Europe will gain, or at least regain, some of the lost performance vis-a-vis U.S. That's my guess. As I say, I'm not betting on European markets, but I don't see them as being expensive, and I don't see them as operating in a context, at least a monetary context, as difficult as the U.S. Japan doesn't have that problem. Doesn't have a war in its borders. It's had many years of consolidation, many, many years of consolidation. Its banking system, 30 years of consolidation, maybe more. Banks have operated there with nil profits practically when the rates were zero. My thinking is that if you want to look at a developed market that can survive this kind of global environment, as long as it doesn't get too difficult, right? I mean, it could eventually catch up to everybody. It did catch up in the 30s to everybody, but I'm not saying that we're going there. But it could happen. It could actually happen, and it can catch everybody. But if it doesn't get that far, I think Japan can do well. There is a new sort of like a subtle shift, let's call it a subtle shift, in Japanese culture. Some of it has to do with an understanding that they need to have a looser immigration policy. We know the population, the Japanese population is aging quickly, and there's going to be a contraction population, a very severe one in the next 20, 30 years already. So they understand the need for a better immigration policy. They also are turning when it comes to defense. They are, for the first time since the war, planning for increases in their defense budgets, and a significant increase in defense budgets. So there is some slight change. And by the way, I'm not hitting the table and saying this is a great buy. I'm saying that in relative terms, Japan is better placed than the other developed markets. The other thing is, of course, that the Japanese yen, unjustifiably, really has gone down very far, and assets when you look at assets and you convert them into US dollars, they're cheap. They're very, very cheap. The Japanese yen has had a large drop, a very, very large drop. Most of the drop, in my view, has to do with the fact that they kept rates too low. And so carry charges were very favorable. And the carry charge players in the foreign exchange markets, those who look at the interest rate differentials, drove the Japanese yen to ridiculous levels. So to me, that is the single most bullish short-term signal. I can buy a Japanese stock at a 30 or 40% discount. And this is after they've had a lot of consolidation. And the fact is that Japanese securities, equities, for those who like bargains, are selling cheaper today than they were 40 years ago. So, right. So a case the dual can be play. Made. A case, what's that?
You have the dual play. You have the dual play then. You have securities that are cheaply priced and denominated in a currency that's cheaply priced.
Exactly. So again, we're not banging the table. We're not saying that this is phenomenal, because you know, phenomenal is great economic policies, great fiscal policies, great monetary policies. Japan doesn't have any of those, and it's a lousy monetary policy. And this fixing of the yield curve is ridiculous, and they'll have to get out of this, and they are getting out of it, hopefully. But it is in relative terms a cheap market, a very cheap market with none of the serious problems that the other developing markets have. Okay. So for now, we are comfortable being long, mostly Japanese banks, by the way, mostly Japanese banks. And by the way, they're also selling at very cheap multiples of book compared to U.S. banks, right? They're selling at 60 cents of about 60 cents of book approximately, right? So that's cheap. I mean, U.S. banks are selling, the good ones are selling between 1 and 2 times books.
All around,
I think Japan is a relatively good play. It's a good play.
Okay, let's wind up by discussing an old favorite, and of course, we're talking about gold now, aren't we? How can you be? Oof. You've taken a fairly substantial position in gold, and you've taken a substantial position in gold at the same time that you've expressed an anxiety about deflation. What is it about those two statements that don't jibe?
Yeah, I was afraid you'd ask that question. I don't know. All right, so the. the story around gold has always been gold is a good asset to have during inflation. Gold is a good hedge against inflation, and that's a story. And the story is actually supported by the fact that historically, over long periods of time, gold has been a good hedge against inflation. Over long periods of time. In other words, it has kept up with the cost of living. I think there's an old story that says that, and I haven't checked it, that that a suit, I think it was a suit in the UK, would cost in terms of gold the same thing today as it cost 250 years ago, something of that sort. You know, that was a famous story, at least circulating 30 years ago. So in the long run, yes, gold does have the properties of being a good hedge. But let me tell you something. You don't want to hang on that story in for short periods of time. You don't want to bet on that in a 10-year or 20-year period. You know, you don't want to be there because it's not going to work for you. But it will work for you if you can live to 120 years. So the question now is, where are we in that cycle? What makes gold rise to match the price level in dollar terms is that gold has to be extracted from the ground. There's cost involved in extracting it from the ground. There's energy costs, labor costs, and transportation costs. And these costs rise with inflation. And so the cost of extracting gold rises with inflation. And so if you want to continue to have a supply, an adequate, quote unquote, adequate supply of gold, you'd have to see prices go up enough to compensate for those rising costs. That's why gold keeps pace with inflation. Now, then you can say to me, well, you know, maybe it's just a barbaric metal. Maybe it is what they used to be called that way. I think Lord Keynes called it a barbaric metal or a barbaric acid or something of that sort, right?
He did.
So what do you need it for? What do you need? Who needs it? Well, the first answer is, well, there is a demand for gold for jewelry and has been there for 5,000 years. So you can't get rid of it. I mean, women do like gold rings, and even men like gold rings and gold bracelets and gold whatever, you know, gold made things. So gold has a demand from a consumption point of view, it has a demand. But in addition to that, and this is key, gold has been a significant portion, has represented a significant portion of international reserves of central banks ever since central banks were invented in the mid-18th century. So gold always had a favorable kind of a significant proportion in central banks' reserves. That actually began to change in the early 80s when for about 15 or 20 years, central banks decided that they wanted out of gold. They didn't see the need for it, and the world was doing very well without it, and we had mostly floating currency, so you didn't need reserves or much reserves. So countries like Canada literally got rid of all their gold. Countries like Switzerland got rid of half of their gold. Britain got rid of half of its gold, or more than half. So suddenly the demand for reserve, which was always there, began to disappear. And that led to prices drop all the way to $300 an ounce, so $250 or $300 an ounce in the late 90s. And we know the story after that, you know, central banks around the world decided that they have to come to some agreement because they're still holding a lot of gold and they didn't want the price to go down to zero. So they came to an agreement that they would do some orderly sales. So if they wanted to sell, anybody can sell, but it would be in an orderly form. And that prices began to recover. And then sometime in the mid-2000s, something began to happen where many central banks around the world felt that they needed to have gold in the reserves regardless because of the political situation, because the world was beginning to divide in blocks, in political blocks. And so for the past 10, 12 years, central banks have been accumulating gold on a net basis every quarter, practically every quarter. And last quarter was the largest, we saw the largest amount of gold purchased by central banks, not only in quantity, but also in breadth. A lot of countries were involved in doing that. And of course, we always have the big elephant in the room is China. China still has today under $2 trillion worth of treasuries in their portfolio. And it's unlikely that they'll want to keep that. And sooner or later, China will have to deploy it and buy at least substitute some of it with gold. They are buying gold. They may not be able to deploy all of it, or the $2 trillion, and they may end up buying copper and oil and other things, and maybe some other currency. But right now, it looks to me like it's likely that a good portion of that money will eventually go to gold. So the demand for gold is coming from two places, from two quarters. Consumption, we have a lot of gold being used in, for instance, places like India, where it's used for jewelry, and it's used all over the world for jewelry. And that maybe consumes more than half of the gold produced, and then the rest is coming from central banks, and the residual is investment demand. So when investment demand is strong, it tilts the prices higher. If investment demand is weak, or we're liquidating gold, let's say the public is liquidating gold, then the price will go down. It's sort of the residual value, the marginal value is there today. It was mostly central banks in the 90s, late 90s, mid 90s. But today, the marginal buyer and marginal seller is still the public. Right now, the public has been a buyer, not in the last year, let's say, but the public has been generally on the plus side. But we're starting to see more central bank demands. So that can be also a big factor. So one feeds on the other. Central bank demand, prices going up. The public, the investing public is usually reacts to prices. The higher the price, the more investment demand. It's not the way it is with other commodities. The higher the price, the less the demand. The higher the price, the higher the investment demand. Probably a little less consumption, though. You know, so we do see Indian consumption, for example, drop when prices go up a lot. That's the story. So in the coming environment that we see, where I think we both agree, and almost everybody would agree, that if the economy goes in the tailspin, the Fed will lower rates. And the question is how quickly, but they will lower rates. And I would have to believe that lower rates would be very bullish for gold because the opportunity cost becomes much smaller.
Right.
You know, consumption will drop off. There's no question the consumption will drop off a bit. But when you look at the world today and you see the political blocks being formed, you know, the Russia-China axis, many independent countries who don't want to necessarily be so tied to the U.S., the huge amount of money being generated and made in the Middle East, given what's happening with the price of oil, in the trillions of dollars, you have to say that gold happens to be sitting in a good position, and it's cheap at this level. It is cheap at this level.
Clear and thorough. Thank you. I think this is a good place to wind it up. Last year was a good year for many hedge funds, large hedge funds in particular. And one of the reasons for that was that in a bear market, the big stocks, the stocks that were originally called FANG stocks, the number of stocks that fell into that FANG kind of category changed over the course of the year. But as they fell, it gave an opportunity to stock pickers to choose amongst a wider dispersion of securities to be able to capture alpha. You outperformed the S&P by a very wide margin last year, and you did it completely without investing in stocks by making like the really traditional macro calls. It was a great year, and listeners, I'm sure, are hoping that you can do the same. Take the opportunity to congratulate you on that next year and to wish you the best for 2023. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, David. Great. Have a great day. Have a sunny day.
Right back at you, man. Right back at you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.